I'd like to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. It's February 13th. Time is 1:40, and for the record, we have Representative Kelly, Representative Foster,
myself, Representative Meyer, and Representative Stoltz, Representative Petula, and Representative Hocker, and Representative Weirich.
I believe Representative Lawrence is downstairs testifying on a bill. Is that correct?
I believe he's down there opposing my bill. Yes, sir.
Opposing. Okay. Well, we appreciate you being here.
Yes, but this gives me a chance to address unopposed.
Okay. Very good. Well, this afternoon we're going to be hearing three bills. House Bill 331, Underage Military on Licensed Premises. House Bill 357, Statutory References to Disabilities. And House Bill 150, Licensing Radiologic Technicians. House Bill 334, which the sponsor is Representative Remmers, who is also tied up downstairs in the Resources Committee. He's asked that we hold this bill over till tomorrow. So we won't be hearing House Bill 334 today. So, is there anything else to come before the committee before we get started?
Mr. Chairman, I've always heard this was the very powerful Finance Committee, and if you're the powerful co-chairs, I wonder if these fellows have their priorities straight.
Okay, we won't go there. Actually, we have a birthday today too, but we'll we're missing
singing.
after this morning. Okay, House Bill 331, Underage Military on Licensed Premises. This is Representative Elkins's bill, and on his behalf is his trusty staff, Mr. Van Horn. And Mr. Van Horn, do you want to go ahead and introduce the bill to us and tell us what it's about? I understand we do have a new fiscal note, but it's a minor correction.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Van Horn. I'm on the staff of Representative Jim Elkins. Representative Elkins is down at the Resources Committee and will not be able to be here today. Before you is House Bill number 331, which is a simple single-page bill that amends Alaska Statute 04-11-110G by authorizing access by persons under 21 years of age who possess a valid military ID card to a club's licensed premises without specific authorization of the ABC Board in certain circumstances. Under present state law, persons under the age of 21 cannot be on premises licensed to sell alcoholic beverages unless a parent or legal guardian accompanies them. At the same time, it is recognized that the federal government is a legal guardian of those active duty personnel under the age of 21. All active duty personnel are eligible for membership in veterans organizations, including those under the age of 21. Current law causes a dilemma to the underage person. Here they are, eligible to join an organization, but unable to go to the meetings because they are underage. This legislation in no way, and I repeat, no way, will allow the consumption of alcoholic beverages by persons under the age of 21 in licensed clubs. It will allow active duty people under 21 to avail themselves of the club's amenities, such as television, pool table, lounge, etc., along with the camaraderie of other veterans. What brought this about initially was a situation down in Seward where a Coast Guard vessel come into the shipyard and they're there for an extended period of time and the underage individuals didn't have much to do in the town. And this will allow them to do that as long as, and as well as other veterans organizations, clubs, throughout the state. I'm open for any questions.
Okay, very good. Any questions for the sponsor?
Representative Stokes. Thank you, my colleague from the Valley and the Senate side is working. This is companion legislation.
This is companion legislation to Senator Huggins' bill. Yes, sir. Okay. Through the chair, excuse me.
Very good. Well, let's see which one goes fast first.
It's a matter of minutes.
Yeah. I do have a question. I guess the concern I would have, maybe it's not that big a concern, but if we do allow, let's just say, a 20-year-old Marine to go into the VFW, and he doesn't get served, but yet he takes drinks off the table where there is a beverage, and maybe has several that way, and then would ultimately then drive home and get in an accident. Do you think the VFW club, would they be liable then for, is that a concern of yours?
Mr. Chairman, no, it's not. It's a concern of the club itself, because each organization, each club, is like any other lounge or a bar has someone underage comes in. In this situation, it would be the falling the shoulders of the club itself, because they are licensed under the current law itself to dispense alcoholic beverages. And it's something that they are aware of, and it's something that they do have special occasions, like a military appreciation night or something like that, and they do let in underage people in there then, and they have to watch it then. Every club in the state, all their bartenders hold TAMS cards and have received that training as required by state law.
Yeah, no, and you're absolutely right. It's no different than restaurants that serve.
Yes, sir.
In fact, I often wondered, Chuck E. Cheese, I don't know if you're familiar with Chuck E. Cheese, but they do have beer and wine there, and of course there's kids everywhere.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd just like to add to Mr. McLean's testimony, it's a Marine that's 20 years old, probably has the guile intelligence to know how to go and procure alcohol if that's his intent, but it's been my experience, it's really a matter of pride, whether it's post 33 and Peters Creek and American Legion, post 15 and Palmer and the VFW and Eagle River Valley, the ones I'm more familiar with. It's a real source of pride to bring in these new members, and it's VFW's American Legion's have been an aging group, and with both Desert Storm and now Operation Enduring Freedom, it's a real source of pride for these posts and. What's the term for the VFW posts and the they're both called posts.
They're both called posts, yes.
Okay, thanks. They really take them out pride in bringing in these members, and it's certainly there's a lot better ways for these young heroes to get alcohol. It's not about alcohol consumption. That's
yes, sir.
Speech.
Okay. Very good. And then the fiscal note, what changed? We just made it. There was a typo, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. There was a 1.5 down on one of the lines. It didn't really compute. It didn't add up. There was no other figures on the original fiscal note, and this is just a housekeeping amendment to that fiscal note. And okay. By the way, for the record, it is a zero fiscal note.
Yeah, I was going to say there's still zero, so that's the main thing.
Yes, sir.
All right, President Wire, did you have a question? Okay. President Hawker?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The exemption we're carving out here is for someone possessing a valid active duty identification card. Does this go far enough? What was the rationale to limit it to someone currently possessing a valid active duty card? It seemed, I guess I'm thinking in terms of someone that's in the Guard or some other designation where they are in fact, serving but not necessarily with a valid active duty card, or have been in and out legitimately as, no longer serving actively but have been in and are now back out.
Through the chair to you, Representative Hawker, the original intent was for active duty personnel. This was brought up this same question was brought up by Representative Lynn, because he wanted everybody to come in there if they could. A lot of times you have people that are in the Guard or Reserve who are on active, temporary active duty. They would have a card, but they would have a copy of maybe the papers that show that their orders to active duty. We have a situation like this in Ketchikan. They have an organization called the Joint Task Force is building a road from Metlakatla to Walden Point over about a 5 or 6 year stage. It's a training, military training. They bring in reservists, active duty, maybe Air Force, Navy CBs, and so forth, Army engineers. and they're there for 2 weeks. And they are actually on active duty, even though they've got a reservist card. And they avail themselves, they have been, of the VFW post there, that they're waiting for their boat to pick them up on Sunday morning to go back over to work. And they come in, they have a real nice breakfast, but they're brought in as guests. And they can get out of the weather, and while they're waiting for the few times it does rain in Ketchikan, they can come in out of the weather and avail themselves of the amenities of that post. And this is one of the situations that come up. Right now, we're just seeing active duty military personnel, people that are on active duty.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess that it is the sponsor's conclusion that the bill goes far enough to accomplish the task that he wishes to accomplish.
I think one step at a time, through the chair to you, Representative Hogger, I think one step at a time to see how it works out. And maybe it could be amended later on. Right now, we're just trying to get these people into the post and work with the veterans and have them enjoy the amenities of that post.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. For the record, Representative Holm has joined us, as well as Representative Jewell. We could have used you this morning. To, well,
I had another meeting, but I appreciate that. I apologize to my good friend from Juneau, but my dulcimer tones didn't carry the day.
That's pretty ugly. Yeah. Representative Hawker, you're a mess.
You owe apologies to far more people than me.
Okay, if there's no other questions for the sponsor, we do have a few people who've asked to testify, so we'll go right to public testimony. First person I have is Clayton Love, who I believe is here in Juneau. We do have, if there are questions, Terry Park, Military and Veterans Affairs. Okay, good. Okay, go ahead, sir. Just if you'll give us your name again for the record and what your affiliation is, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Clayton Love. I'm the commander for the Disabled American Veterans Department of Alaska. I'm also a part of the joint venture that came through a week ago. And mainly what I wanted to say on this bill is that the veterans organizations like the VFW, American Legion, they do a real good job on policing up after themselves. I mean, if I go in without my American Legion card, now they will have a list or a roster saying, okay, you are a member, you know, but the ID card is like the government sponsoring that little individual to come into the establishment. I'm not saying he can drink, but to have the camaraderie with other veterans, to partake in a welcome home ceremony after spending a year in Iraq, you know. And it treats them all fair. They spend a year dodging the bullet with the older guys. The older guys who come to the VFW, and they can still come in. And if they get caught drinking, they'll get carded. They'll be asked to leave. If that individual has consumed, like some individuals are concerned, has consumed alcohol prior to coming to that establishment, they won't let him in. And the organizations have really, really discussed this real hard to make sure that these situations don't happen, but yet the camaraderie of active duty and the veterans and the socializing can still happen. And the bartenders know. You know, you got Fort Rich, Elmendorf, up in Anchorage, you've got Wainwright, Eielson, and those are the biggest group of people that are coming and going as far as combat situations. And it's just a nice, friendly atmosphere, you know. Veterans understand veterans more than anything else, especially in a combat bed. And it's just a way of saying thank you. And not just the veteran support, but the state support and appreciation for what they've done, what we've done in the past, and what they're going to be doing in the future. But as far as the consumption of alcohol, that would be strictly no. And that's basically all that I've got to say about it.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Love? Thank you, Mr. Love. Say none. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon
for your service. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
State Priest Court.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Williams. Or, I'm sorry, Wilkins. Let me put my glasses on. Is he short? Yeah. Welcome, Mr. Wilkins.
Good afternoon. I'm John Wilkins, Director of Services for the Disabled American Veterans Department of Alaska. And I can't say much more than what Commander Love said, except allowing our young people into these facilities, VFW and American Legion, will allow us old troops to mentor the young people. I don't care if the war is in a jungle, in a desert, or in the street. A bullet is a bullet. And what we've learned, we can pass to these young people. Now, as far as young people drinking, no. We will, like we do now, police ourselves. And I believe someone brought up, if by some strange chance one of the younger people sitting at somebody's table and drank their drink, and I believe he said had an accident going home, who would be responsible? The club would. The state would not be responsible for something like that. We police ourselves very stringently, and if this bill is passed, I'm sure it's going to get a lot tight, just because we will be allowing underage people in. Other than that, the young people need our guidance. The camaraderie, the troops come back from overseas, we want to have a celebratory get-together for them, or just come on in, guys, and join us. We can't do it. We would like to be treated basically the same as a restaurant. We ask for ID cards. If you're not old enough, you don't drink. Drink a Pepsi. Better for you anyway. That's about it.
Okay, very good. We have a question
for Mr. Chairman, just teeing off of Representative Hawker's question. Does this the current narrow definition of active duty exclude anyone that you wish you were able to bring in, or is it okay as it is? I'm asking the same question Representative Hawker did, but from your perspective.
To me, it's okay as it is.
Okay.
Active duty. You're fighting a war.
That's I think, where Representative Hawker was going. That works for you, works for me.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Wilkins?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your service. Appreciate everything you've done for us. Okay. Mr. Colbert? Howard Colbert? Yeah.
Before you get going, thank you for your time.
Sure.
Because I probably forget this. My name is Howard Colbert. I'm the commander of DAV Chapter 4 Juneau. A little background information is, you know, the DAV was set up by Congress, and it's stipulated that wherever we meet, there's no alcohol can be served. We are kind of on a shoestring budget. We got a dollar. We have to have change back in order for us to keep operating. Well, I'm not asking for money. We basically meet at the Mendenhall Library on the third Friday of the month. And we basically deal with people with disabilities, with problems, with paperwork and so forth. Well, because we don't really have a home, per se, the American Legion, the VFW, allows us to go into their organizations or into their meeting halls and so forth, and allows us to serve the veterans by doing paperwork and so forth. When we're allowed to go into these clubs to which... to do the paperwork and stuff for these young troops, because this is basically their peer groups. They kind of sit together in their peer groups. They're like libraries. These guys and these VFWs and these American Legions have volumes of information for younger troops. As long as our federal government are handing weapons to kids that are 17, 18, 19, 20, you're going to have problems. I mean, that's just the way it is. The younger people are the only ones can fight wars, because those older guys know better. The younger people, like you say, can go into these organizations, and they do police themselves. They have their own rules and so forth. And the DAV basically goes in, process paperwork for these guys, you know. And anyway, that is basically, you get the younger people that comes into these clubs, and this is just where we meet. We don't advocate anything. We just try to help the fellows down the road just a little bit, and that's basically what we do. I think that's about it. Do you have any questions?
Okay, because I appreciate the testimony, Mr. Colbert. Any questions? Did a good job.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. And again, thank you for your service to the country and for coming here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you. I believe that's all we had signed up to testify. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on the House Bill 331? Okay. Hopefully we have anybody online. Actually, can I have Canada, can I have the police look first in
the house? Oh, I hear it's the voice.
There's some coming. He's ahead of us. Everybody wants to sign on to your bill, sir. Or Representative Wilkinson or Elkins. Okay, you want to come back up, Mr. Van Horn?
While yes, we're waiting, I wonder if I could just draw attention to Cadet Major Gallimali there.
Sure.
In Alaska. Yeah, I just wanted to thank him for coming. Yeah.
Thank you also for your service to the country.
While we're waiting, I've spent a lot of time searching the Peters Creek American Legion. It has a real family-like atmosphere, and they watch each other's backs in the park, and it's there to serve their membership, and I think there's a lot of validity that they will be self-policing. There's a camaraderie that doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in other drinking establishments. It's a club that happens to have alcohol. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if Senator Huggins' bill comes before this committee, the person presenting it will be a young gentleman named Josh Temple. I don't know if you've met him yet. He's from Anchorage. He's in Marine Reserve. He just came back from a year in Iraq. Very, very fine young man.
Very good. Yes, I think most of us have met Josh. Is there any questions for Mr. Van Horn? Before we...
Mr. Representative Stoltz has
things. I'm a little worried about your vote count, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, I think we're ready here for a motion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Before we go any further, was there a good representative to your immediate left talking about this body here, about how we don't oversee ourselves?
I'm talking about you.
Okay, if there's no other questions, let's move on. Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move HB 331 out of committee with the three attached fiscal notes and zero fiscal notes and within the book of recommendations. And I wanted to thank Mr. Van Horn for a good job.
Okay. And that third. The amended fiscal note is the one you want, the latest fiscal note?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. Any objections? Seeing none, the bill passes out of committee. Thank you, Mr. Van Horn.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you to our military folks here this afternoon.
I'm not.
Okay, Representative Wilson. Good to see you, Representative Wilson. Is this your first time this year up here?
Yes, it is.
All right. Okay, so the next bill before us is House Bill 357. We do have the sponsor here. And let's see. Okay. Well, that I'll just turn it over to you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the bill itself is pretty self-explanatory. It just updates the terminology in our statutes for persons with disabilities. And in the process of doing that, we kind of give people with disabilities a little more dignity. After the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, most states modified their statutes to reflect a positive reference to a person with a disability, because before it was handicapped. So Alaska didn't do that. And this bill changes all Alaska state statutes to rid them of this archaic reference, and that has a negative and demoralizing connotations in reference to a person's ability and potential. Using a person with a disability reflects the language that is in the federal legislation. It's in the Federal Workforce Investment Act, it's in the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Civil Rights Act of 91, Individuals with Disability Education Act, and the Rehabilitation Act of 73, which was amended in 92 and 98. So these changes were made in consultation with the Department of Labor, other state agencies, and along with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. This bill is not designed to modify anything in the statutes except the terminology. It doesn't change the meaning of anything at all. This bill is designed to serve the constituents of everyone across the state and that are affected by the existing negative terminology. And I think I got a letter from the Southeast Alaska Independent Living Group, and I'd like to read the paragraph that they had. It says, American culture consistently redefines itself through language and subcultures. Often, in order to do this, they often use language to redefine themselves. Negroes became blacks, then Afro-Americans. Homosexuals chose the term gay for themselves. People with disabilities have done the same during the years, attempting to fight the stereotypes and the negative imagery. So, if you have any other questions, I ask for your support for House Bill 357, and it just modernizes the language that would be in our Alaska statutes.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Wilson. Any questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, doing a good job. Might want to just stand by though for a little bit if you can. We do have some people who would like to testify. Gail Stevenson. How are you? Okay, Gail. Just join us. You're Don, right? Okay. All right. You want to go first, Ms. Sennett, and then get for the record to tell us your name and your affiliation.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Gail Sennett, and I'm the director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, which is in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I have Don Brandon with me. He works at the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation as our Americans with Disability Act coordinator for the state. I would like to thank Representative Wilson for introducing House Bill 357. That would change the language in Alaska state statutes from handicapped persons to persons with disability. This is not just a Department of Labor and Workforce Development bill. It crosses over the Department of Health and Social Services, Transportation, Education and Early Development, Commerce and Economic Development, Law and Administration. The word handicap is simply an old term. It is a term that evokes negative images such as pity and a lower class citizen. The word handicap puts the emphasis on what they cannot do and not the emphasis on what a person's abilities are. This language would mirror the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 as amended, the Workforce Development Act, and the Americans with Disability Act, as well as many other federal laws. House Bill 357 has garnered support from the Governor's Committee on Employment of Persons with Disabilities, the Governor's Council on Special Education, the State Independent Living Council, and all independent living centers throughout the state of Alaska. The proposed language is a positive change, and I believe it's the right thing to do. It has a zero fiscal note attached to it. I would appreciate if House Bill 357 can be passed out of committee. Do you have any questions?
Yeah. Any questions? Representative Stokes has a question.
Thanks. I support the language change, but I'm always worried about how this affects private businesses. This ABA has had a lot of unintended consequences. If I have a restaurateur in my community that has a sign up that says handicap that parking, there are some litigation happy people. I just want to be a little gun shy about signing onto a bill that's going to bring an enforcement agency so that he's got to change that sign that he just put up this year. Is there a transitional effect on this, or what are the I've read the bill. I don't see what the teeth are, but I also know that we have an active judicial branch, and it's often it might be easier for the person to say, okay, I'm getting sued by the Disability Law Center, and I might as well replace this $600 sign I put up rather than go through a hassle. And can you address some of those concerns?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I appreciate your concerns. This is simply a bill to change the Alaska state statutes. It doesn't change the law whatsoever. Just as an informational piece, they are changing the word handicapped on accessible parking signs, and this is happening gradually, and there's no repercussions for having an old sign that says handicapped parking. I don't believe that this bill would have anything to do with the private or the product.
Sure. I think there were a lot of surprises when the 1991 ABA bill passed that they didn't think were going to be affected, and that's had great intent, but a lot of consequences that nearly put some people out of business who were making swift faked efforts. Would the sponsor have any? Would the sponsor have any problem with a letter of intent or some other mechanism to relating to this legislation? And I wouldn't try to cobble one together now, but before this got to the floor, I'd like to work with you. Would you see the direction I'm going? You probably share those that it's not our intent that this be to cause expenses for businesses to transition before they would have normally replaced signs.
Go ahead, Ms. Sim, do you have a comment on that? And then we'll bring up the sponsor at the end of the testimony.
Right. I was just going to offer Don Brandon as the ADA coordinator to answer those questions because it's not something I'm totally familiar with.
Okay. Well, actually, why don't we go ahead and once you proceed with your testimony, then we'll go to the questions from both.
Okay. And I'll try to address your question, Representative Stoltz, in the process of my comments. I want to thank you all for the opportunity of addressing House Bill 357.
Again, if you could give us your name.
My name is Don Brandon,
okay.
And I serve as the state ADA coordinator. Okay. And my office is located right here in Juneau, so I'm available if you have any questions or need to any technical assistance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. I was injured in a car accident when I was 17 on the way to school. For the next 12 years after my car accident, I did something pretty amazingly resistant in regards to the way I dealt with disability. I avoided people with disabilities like the plague. And the reason I had that attitude about disability was because it was an attitude I brought into my experience with disability. And for the first 12 years after my car accident, I couldn't find a comfortable spot for me in society because of the references that were used about me and the experience that I had with disability. And then one day, I got a job working for an organization called Access Alaska. And my first day on the job, I'm using words that are reflected in our state laws. Handicapped. Infirm. Because I couldn't find the right word. And my first day on the job, someone introduced me to a phrase that totally changed and transformed my life. And for the last 22 years, I have been comfortable with who I am in my experience with disability. And the phrase that he gave me was this, a person with a disability, not a handicapped person. Because philosophically, I believed But there's a difference between who I am and what I have. Because of who I am, I can deal with what I have. I am a person. I have a disability. It's a part of the normal experience of our everyday life. And one of the fascinating things in this little door that opened a large room dealing with disability was the discovery of language and its effect on us as a society. And when you look at the language, for instance, Representative Stoltz referenced handicap parking. If you look on those signs that have the international symbol of accessibility on them, the thing that enforces that parking is not the language above it. It's the statement that says AS, whatever the Alaska state law is that references it. And by going through a catharsis process and a cleansing process, it's not what gives that sign validity and power is the statement it's an Alaska statute. And so our Alaska statute is what's going to change and be modified. Now, it's true that there have been a lot of concerns about the ADA, some valid, some not. Now, one of the concerns that I think will take place and transform over time will be that that spot that's 16 feet wide with a sign in front of it with the International Symbol of Accessibility on it, you'll start seeing those signs being transformed just in the course of the industry itself. They'll stop selling handicap parking signs in Alaska because the statute has language that reflects accessible parking. And that doesn't take away it at all from the power behind that sign. It's the statute itself. It's the Alaska statute that's written on every one of those signs. So you're concerned about the language not being exactly correct. It doesn't show up as strong as you may first think, because they can't be sued over language on a sign. It's the law that enforces it itself. And when that language changes, the natural course of events of the signage will change as well.
Just on that point,
does that conclude your testimony, sir?
Yes.
Further question?
On that point, I hope that's all accurate, but I just have never felt to depend upon what a litigant and the judiciary is going to do. Even being sued is a terrible burden. I've dealt with some people in the community that in the disabled community that they're looking for lawsuits, and that's they're not the majority by any measure, but they're out there. I think, as we all know, that there are lawyers out there that are looking for those opportunities, and just I don't underestimate the possibility of anything like this.
And I agree with Representative Stoltz, but there's a reason why people have this attitude that they have to use our courts in order to address change. And because the ADA is a law that it's complaint-driven, that's just the natural course of events. There's not an official that goes around policing these organizations on their own. It's the public themselves. And part of the reason is people develop these attitudes of using the complaint process that's in the law is because if you have an obvious disability, you experience discrimination on a daily basis. If you have an obvious disability, there are at least 10 to 20 references to your difference every day. And over time, that becomes pretty toxic on you emotionally. And when you can't get in a certain place or you can't use the accessible parking because someone else is misusing it, those types of things have an effect on people and the way they're treated.
Thank you. Representative Holm and then Representative Kelly.
Just another question along the same line.
I just cut in line on your buddy.
It's not right. It's right. The process. Go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead. Pardon me.
No, go ahead.
I didn't mean to do that.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. I did. Anyway, welcome to Don. He's from up in our neck of the woods, Benjamin. The question I have is, like Representative Stoltz, I support the change. And it's been identified as not having other downstream impacts. But after that question, it brought another question to me, because there was a lot of backlash when this, everything's a pendulum. And so when it first came in, there were a lot of businesses that were very resentful over the nearly knocking them out of business aspect that came along with it. Fair or unfair, just fact. There was a backlash. And so we don't want to do anything here that we didn't intend to do. Everything we do in this room should be with all kinds of malice aforethought. And I see in Representative Stoltz talking about the private community. I also don't want to see DOT or anybody else going out and changing out any perfectly good signs. Are we okay there? I mean, that's another element that I hadn't even thought of. If all of a sudden we change out Alaska's signs that identify handicap parking, whether they're state or municipal or private, that's not where you're going with this, and that's not where you intend to go. And I think by making this record like we're doing here, we make that clear. So I'm very supportive of the bill. I just don't want to have an unintended consequence that you didn't ask for anyway. I support Representative Stoltz in making sure that we get that clear so that we can get the universal support that I think we'll get for this bill without having an unintended expensive consequence.
A good point. Any comments? Okay. Representative Holt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. Don, welcome.
Thank you.
44 years ago, I blew up my dad's garage and I lost half a hand at 16. I am not disabled and I'm not handicapped because it's between my ears. So I respectfully disagree with the notion that people are disabled or handicapped strictly because they have a physical malady. Because a lot of it's driven by between your ears. If you choose to be what you choose to be, you will become it. And I would like to make sure that we don't send a message to people that somehow they can't exceed their highest expectations because we label them. Labeling is such a, as you well know, a deterrent that those who don't have disabilities, handicaps, or infirmities, or whatever we want to call them, don't really recognize. I used to drive basketball left-handed. Kind of hard for me to hold on to it that way. Can't bowl left-handed anymore either. But obviously, it didn't stop me from bowling right-handed. And it didn't stop me from doing other things. And surprisingly enough, many times when we have problems that don't allow us to do things the way other people do them, we find that we can do other things far better than we thought we could to begin with. Challenges are not, and I consider it more as a challenge rather than a disability. And I find that to be a better word because I don't feel disabled. I don't think I act disabled. Some people think I'm intellectually disabled at times, but I don't know that that has anything to do with what we're talking about here. But I would just suggest that sometimes when we go down these roads, we don't really offer society a solution. We just do something differently today, as we talked before about changing our languages, evolving and changing. But I just thought I'd make that message. There's no one here that I think that has what I have that sits at this table today, and I just thought I'd offer that to you.
I appreciate that, but you're saying exactly what I'm saying. Because the language that we're referencing is putting emphasis on the person, because it's the person between your ears, exactly. Your persona that makes a difference, not your handicap. And that's exactly what we're saying.
Very good. Any other questions, comments? Representative Weiber.
Thanks, Mr. Brandon. I know you're so aggressive and active and intelligent in this area. You're the go-to guy, so I appreciate it. I did have a question about Section 1. Is Section 1 of the bill, when we talk about legislative intent, is that really necessary? A lot of times we do this, and it's more often than not necessary when you want to reverse a court case, but I'm not sure in this case if that's necessary. I just want to think about that, Mr. Chairman. And the other question I have is, the bill talks about persons with disabilities and changing the word handicap to disabilities. And it also includes the word aged, like aged is a disability or a handicap. And I don't really agree with that fundamentally, but I don't know if there's a legal reason to do that. And I've been trying to find the definition of aged since Section 16 and 17 of the bill specifically, but I don't. To me, thinking of my mom. I was thinking like Representative Seaton went down to his father's 97th birthday and had to get him off the roof to come into the party. And my mom is will outlive us all. She's 80, but I'm not sure she would agree. She would agree with this. Representative Holmes, but it's certainly a state of mind, because you may be pioneers, you're not disabled, you're not handicapped. So I don't know what the thinking was in that. And
thank you, Representative Clark. Any thoughts, sir?
I can answer that, I think.
Go ahead,
when I was looking at 16, when I was working with Representative Wilson, we were only looking at the words handicap, and aged was already in there, and we just did not go, you know, a step further.
I understand it's different from the intent of what you're doing, Ms. Chairman. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder, as long as you're doing it. Mm-hmm. And then, Ms. Chairman?
Sure, go ahead.
Just on the section one question.
You want to take a shot at that?
No.
Okay.
But, I guess I
understand. I can answer this to a tiny little bit. Okay. I do know that when we were working with Representative Wilson, that we also had Department of Law do a lot of the language. So I can't tell you the intent that Department of Law had, but I do know that that's the section they wrote.
Yeah.
But okay. That's all I can answer on this section.
Okay. Well, we'll again bring the sponsor up. Representative Hawker, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might, and just on this point of Section 1, we'll have Representative Wilson up shortly, but just for the sponsor's reference on this, but maybe I'll wait till she comes up and joins us.
Okay. Representative Wilson, would you like to join us? You folks can stay.
That's right.
But then if I might.
I think the table pulls out.
I actually would like my staff...
Does that table pull out anymore?
Yeah.
Okay, because I think she wants to bring her staff in the first one. There we go.
If my staff, Aaron Danielson, comes up, he did most of the research on it, so okay. He might be able to answer that better than I would.
Sure.
But we did change some things, and Aaron, I'll let you kind of speak to that a little bit.
Okay, my name is Aaron Danielson. I'm an intern for Representative Wilson. And the question about some of the changes we've made in this bill, aged was existing language, as Representative Wyrock was referring to. And the question was just about the changes already, or?
I think there's a question about section 9 and whether or not that was necessary. I don't think we usually have legislative intent, but it's probably okay, Representative
Hawkins. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you'll indulge me a bit to this point,
sure.
Particularly for Representative Wilson and her aide, this committee has, now there are two ways to have some sort of a non-statutory comment accompany legislation. Drafting typically throws in these legislative intent sections, but historically here, legislatively, what we've done is we tend to remove this from the statute itself and have it drafted into an accompanying sponsor's letter that we ratify, approve, and transmit along with the bill. So you get to exactly the same place, but we don't end up with, frankly, Representative Wyrock, you have a better legal analysis, but we get to the same place without quite as much legal clutter. It's something I'm wholly supportive, and particularly as a co-sponsor on your bill with you, we would get to the exact same place in what I think is a more expeditious manner by making that adjustment. So it's, nothing would change what you're doing.
And I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. We can rearrange that just a little bit so that that just accompanies the bill then. And I don't have a problem with that at all. And actually the Department of Labor said they'd help me craft a letter of intent. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We can make a conceptual amendment to do that then if that's your wishes. Representative Wire?
Well, whatever, the committee decides, it's a vehicle also for Representative Kelly and Representative Stoltz, and also to add something to that, whether, however it happens.
Right.
I'm not going anywhere with this, I just want to discuss it.
Okay. Representative Joe?
Just a point of clarification, I think, on the intent language versus the letter of intent.
as I recollect, I think almost every governor has vetoed every piece of intent language that accompanies legislation in many, many cases. And so the letter of intent, as opposed to the intent language in the bill, gets right to where Representative Hawker's talking about. So that's the information you'd like to accompany the bill. If a governor is going to veto intent language, then you're covered somewhere else.
You should bring up Mr. Ford there, but I know you're here for a different bill, so I'm not. Okay, well, we can do it either way. It's up to the sponsor as far as I'm concerned.
And Mr. Chairman, while Representative Wilson's at the table, the concerns that Representative Kelly and I represented, would you be, I don't want to slow it down here and drafting it, but would you will be able to incorporate those concerns about?
Absolutely.
So, Mr. Chairman, would you be amenable to a motion to strike Section 1?
Conceptual amendment number 1 to delete Section 1? Is that your...
The latest that you can answer.
Okay, that's your motion here?
Yes, can I object for discussion?
Sure, object. Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, would we not, the motion be not just to strike Section 1, but to... strike Section 1 from the bill as written and move the language and adopt a letter of intent conforming to this language.
Yes, I think that's what
that's exactly what I meant.
Well, Representative Hawker said is what Representative Stoltz exactly meant. Okay.
All right, so that's a conceptual amendment. I think that is a friendly amendment to your amendment, sir.
That's a conceptual amendment. Number one, delete the Section 1 and add that as a letter of intent. Add Section 1 as a letter of intent.
And to further, Mr. Chairman, further friendly, also incorporating that concerns, though we don't have a language of private and government sector expenses. Mm-hmm. I will withdraw my objection, sir.
Okay. The objection has been removed from conceptual amendment number 1. Any other objections? If not, then the conceptual amendment number 1 will be adopted. Anything else concerning this bill that we want to bring up at this time? Seeing none, Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move out of the Finance Committee 8357 as amended to the cash plus commerce with any good organization.
Is that Jack for purposes of discussion?
Sure. Jack?
If your department can just get back to me on the age question, you can look at it in different times. Thank you. I remember my objection.
And the letter
of intent. Okay. As amended and with the letter of intent and with the zero fiscal notes. Do you remove your objection?
No, I did.
Okay. Any other objections? If not, bill passes committee. Thank you. We like the zero fiscal notes.
Why are we here?
Alright, let's just take a brief at ease. We've got a new group coming up.
New group.
Next bill before us is House Bill 190, radiological technicians. Did I say one? What did I say? Oh, I'm sorry. That was before I put on my 150. House Bill 150 is one in front of us at this time. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that that we adopt. So yes, for House Bill number 150, it's the 24-LS04-470/N, Gene Mitchell, 2906, work draft version, for purposes of discussion.
Okay. Any objections? Okay, we'll have the CS before us for discussion purposes. Okay, thank you. Have us at the Heath Hilliard, is that correct?
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak to you. The sponsor apologizes for being unable to attend, but he's actually in judiciary presenting another one of his own bills. So I have before you CS for House Bill 150. As you noted, you are under consideration of version N, and I can direct you through a couple of the key changes. Just briefly, the title is pretty self-explanatory. This is establishing a full licensure for radiologic technicians and a partial licensure for what are called limited radiologic imagers. I want to point, I believe your packet should have the CS that was passed out of judiciary, and that's important because there was, in this new CS, version N, we did remove something that judiciary did, and I wanted to point that to you. The judiciary version U, this will be found on page 2, beginning on line 20. We felt this language, it has to do with specification on the exemption for licensed practitioner. If you look at the back of the bill in the definition section, there's a specific definition for licensed practitioner, which includes physicians, osteopaths, podiatrists, etc. This language was intended to allay some concerns. I believe Representative Wilson had, in the course of her judiciary comments, had expressed some thought that perhaps some of these licensed practitioners did or did not possess necessary training to do this. What we did when we looked at this with Ledge Legal, we discovered that licensed practitioners already have no restriction on their ability to perform x-ray examinations for diagnostic purposes, and there was some concern that this language, while sort of unclear and a little nebulous, perhaps would create problems with existing scope of practice statutes. So we removed that in this version N. In addition, I want to point to two other major changes, and I direct you to page 4, and this is on version in version N. Page 4, beginning on line 24, this has to do with the option, the formal education training or applied experience option for qualifying for limited radiologic imagers. These are the lower level, essentially frontline imagers, especially common in rural areas. There was some concern in the judiciary version that we had a discussion about sufficient experience, and some expressed concern that that was not defined specifically enough, and it could be it would be applied at the discretion of the division, and that we wanted to clarify that. So in this particular version, we have stipulated 2 years of clinical experience. So it has a time certain, but more importantly, we chose the sponsor chose 2 years because this bill has a 2-year delayed effective date. So anyone performing these duties from the bill's passage to the time the bill becomes effective, the law becomes effective, would qualify instantly for that applied experience and would not need to enroll specifically in a new program. Lastly, the major change is on page 5, and I would direct you to beginning on line 18 after patient care and safety, or if the program is instructed by and under the supervision of a fully licensed radiographer or licensed practitioner and sponsored by a medical facility as defined in AS 18-26900. The reason we added that is because there is some concern that there are a number of facilities out in rural Alaska in particular that are providing some degree, some level of training for their individuals performing these tasks, and that their training and their training programs would not qualify specifically under the earlier definitions. And so we went to great length to develop language that would say any facility that's providing this training under the supervision of a radiographer or a licensed practitioner, any supervision in those circumstances would be acceptable. The applicants would still have to pass an examination, but any training program in any facility would qualify as a training program. So those were the most significant changes, and our desire was to address some of the concerns that have been brought to us from practitioners in rural Alaska, and we think that these amendments go to great length to doing exactly that. So with that, I know that there are I know a number of people that want to testify, and I also believe that you have an amendment to consider, so I will answer questions as best I can or direct you to the appropriate people that I believe are online.
Okay, very good. I think we do have some questions.
Representative Petula? So, am I hearing you right that you've changed the licensed practitioner language from the new version to the Work Draft N version? Because I'm not finding it in my bill.
Through the chair, Representative Petula, I don't understand your question.
I'm sorry, and I may have misunderstood what you testified to, but I thought that you said that you had changed licensed practitioner from...
Through the chair, Representative Crutula, if you look at version U, there is an exemption at the top of the page. This is on line 5, licensed practitioner. And then pursuant to that, going down to line 20, the Judiciary Committee added that section C, a licensed practitioner may perform an examination. And again, because we believe that was rather subjective language, and we believe it might impact current scope of practice considerations in statute, we removed it.
Okay, thank
you. That section has been removed.
Thanks, that's what I missed. Thanks.
Okay.
Very good. Representative Stokes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. can you discuss what the serious health risks are that you refer to in the sponsor statement, and maybe some anecdotal or factual information about things that have occurred that we need to prevent from happening again?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I would be glad to. I have provided for you in your packet a number of resources, and I believe we have Mr. Clyde Pierce from the Department of Health and Social Services online that I believe can speak to some of those because he has provided some of the information. But I do have two articles that I've presented to you for your consideration. One is a report from the University of California, Berkeley, and one is an article from the Sacramento Bee talking about some legislation currently in California demonstrating concern for the ongoing problem of overexposure of radiation through standard medical x-rays. The UC Berkeley report offers some pretty startling evidence to discuss that over-radiation is, in fact, a real concern for public health. And that was reiterated by Dr. Monsager, our director of public health, in his testimony to the Judiciary Committee, that overexposure is a far greater problem than I think many people realize. And I can't speak to the science, obviously, of the report from University of California, Berkeley, but I can speak to the credibility of the institution, and I believe that the report does highlight a couple of things, and there was actually one quote that I read into the record for Judiciary that I would like to also do for this committee, if the chair would entertain that. This is actually on page 2 or 3 of the report from UC Berkeley, and this is a quote from the report. "There is the assumption that at these doses, radiation doesn't make a significant contribution," he said, "but x-rays are very potent mutagens even at low doses. It's a disaster that people still believe the safe dose myth that low doses are harmless." And I believe that is but one example of addressing your question, Representative Stoltz. And I do know that Mr. Pierce from HESC can probably elaborate further on some of the things that are going on throughout Alaska.
Yeah, and by the way, he is online.
Okay.
We can save that question for him.
Representative Stoltz? Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I was trying to get to a simpler answer. The what causes a guy from East Anchorage to jump into the radiological issue? And, you know, there's somebody, normally when I get involved with something, somebody's said, this is a serious health risk because of these reasons, and this has happened, and I've heard studies and reports, but
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, to be honest with you, I couldn't actually tell you why Representative Anderson had chosen to do this. I believe that he finds it a legitimate health concern, but that would be a question I would have to leave to him.
That's fine, thank you, Representative.
Okay, Bruce, your question.
Yeah, I think I asked you before. This still doesn't apply to dental x-ray treatment.
Through the chair, Representative Foster, if you'll notice on the list of exemptions, it does not apply to dental assistants, and it does not apply to dental hygienists or obviously dentists.
Okay, let me go to Representative Wire.
Yes,
just wondered what group does want this bill. I mean, where does this come from?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, this is being supported by the Alaska Association of Radiologic Technicians. In addition, this bill is being supported by the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association and the Alaska State Medical Association, and we've been working with other groups to address some of the concerns. In addition, this bill has been essentially, we've taken this from model language from the American Association of Radiologic Technicians, which have been leading the forefront for the licensure, and to this point, there are 41 states with licensures, the earliest of which was New York, which is nearly 40 years ago.
How many people would lose their job because of this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, I couldn't answer that definitively. We have taken great measure to try to prevent that, because clearly the issue of access is also important for public health. That is why this is built in, a two-year delayed effective date. There are temporary permits that are being built in to allow people time to pass the examinations. What you're going to find is that most of the people acting as full radiographers today already have a certification from a national organization that would essentially qualify. They'd have to pass a state exam. My understanding from speaking with other people on this bill that know the licensure requirements in other states assure me that those that are acting in full capacities would have no problem. What we're trying to do is protect the broader public health by ensuring that people doing this on a case-by-case basis that are not full radiographers have at least some basic training to understand how to safely and effectively operate the equipment. So for me to say definitively without question that no one would lose their job, I don't believe that would be a statement I could make conclusively. However, I believe that this bill has taken great measure, especially in its newest version, to prevent that from happening, or to go to great length to try to prevent that from happening.
How many complaints have been lodged because of the current situation without this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, to my knowledge, there have not been any in this state.
And so we need it because?
Well, through the chair, Representative Wyrock, I believe that we can demonstrate that this is a serious public health issue, and that we need to make sure that the people doing this, especially those with, at this point in time, no training requirement, have some indeed, so that they are operating it safely and effectively.
Very good. I had asked a similar question about folks out in rural Alaska. How would they get the training? And I'm told you can get the training online for a relatively small dollar amount.
Representative Meyer, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. There is a training program available through, I believe it's Glacier Valley Community College in Washington. It's a $229 program, and I believe it takes less than one academic semester to complete. But in addition, this additional change that we made with regard to the program approval for the limited imager on page 5 says any facility in the state, so long as they have a doctor or a radiographer teaching somebody how to use it, that program will qualify. We really want to go to great length to allow that to happen. We have the sponsor has no interest in limiting access, but to simply ensure that people doing this have some basic level of training.
Thanks. Maybe it's an old letter, but we have a letter from April 4th or 5 from the State Medical Association that says that they would prefer a registration system rather than licensure. Have they changed their opinion, or do they still hold that opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Katula, as you can tell, this bill has gone through many iterations, and this one is fairly recent. I've been working with the State Medical Association to try to address many of their concerns. I wouldn't feel comfortable speaking on their behalf. I can say that we are working very hard to come to a point where they are comfortable. I don't know if Mr. Jordan, who is the head of the State Medical Association, is online. He may want to respond to that, or I could perhaps get him for the committee to respond to that if that would be the committee's desire.
Well, I really appreciate the concern about unnecessary x-rays. It is a really big problem, but I'm also concerned about especially areas where it's hard to get x-rays taken, period,
and what kind of problems you might be causing there. So yeah, I'd like to hear what they think. Thanks.
We have a couple more people would like to ask some questions, but I think once we hear some of these experts that are online to testify, and we have a couple here in the audience, that maybe some of these questions will get answered. Representative Holt?
That's perfectly fine, Mr. Chairman. The only question I had is that through the chair, Mr. Hilliard, the comment was made that the dentists, technicians or dental technicians don't have to be registered, and my question to you is why?
Through the chair, Representative Holm, one thing I can respond to is that my understanding, based on Dr. Monsager's testimony, is that dental x-rays don't present quite the carcinogenic, well, nearly the carcinogenic effect as standard medical x-rays. I believe the number he used, and this was in reference, this was in his testimony at the Judiciary Committee, it represents roughly one-tenth the level of exposure to x-rays as a standard medical x-ray does. That would be the only response I would have. I know there has been questions along that line asked previously, and I don't have a response beyond that.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hoffman.
Yes, thank you.
Pass for now. Okay, very good. Thank you, Miller, for your testimony, and you'll stay around. Here in Juneau, we have Mike Ford, who has to testify. And then we do have several online also to testify. Mr. Ford, if you'd like to join us, make you know the routine, if you could tell us your name and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Ford, and I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Native Health Board. It was very interesting to hear the discussion before the committee today, and all I can say is I have a very simple message, which is we think you shouldn't do this. The issue of cost versus benefit is, I think, one this committee is very familiar with. And the benefits of this bill, I think, are arguable at best, but the costs are definite. And the costs in terms of some smaller clinics in rural Alaska are significant. You've heard there have been no complaints in the state of Alaska. True, there are 41 states that have licensing provisions, but none of those 41 states face the same issues we have in Alaska in terms of the cost of health care. We have a system that's very expensive, and this bill, albeit small, perhaps in a small amount, adds to the expense of that system. And I think it would behoove the legislature to be very clear on the benefits side of this before you take the step of requiring licensing, because what we're really talking about is adding requirements to train and supervise individuals who are already trained and supervised. The clients that I represent are typically your smaller rural health clinics, ones that have two, maybe three people working to provide health care. We add another licensing requirement, then that does raise issues of access, it does raise issues of disruption in service, it raises issues of cost. Now, the question about dental hygienists is one of the exemptions in this bill. I would say that raises questions in my mind too, because it's true that when you go in and get your dental x-ray, it's a small exposure. But what about the person who operates the equipment? They're operating that equipment every day and multiple times a day. If in fact there was a problem here, you'd think that problem would still be there, despite the fact that we're talking about a low dose. And I will give some credit to Representative Anderson in the sense that he has tried to make this bill as user-friendly as possible. A two-year delay in effective date. There's a number of provisions in here that try to make it easy for people to comply. But the bottom line is still the same. This is another layer of regulation. It's another expense that will get passed on to you and I when we go in to get services. And so we can't support the bill. And I'll leave it at that and answer any questions you have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ford. Any questions for Mr. Ford? Representative Stokes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ford, just by coincidence, but last week I was in the grocery store in Eagle River, and a physician who does a lot of rural medicine said there's a bill coming through that's going to have an inimical effect on on their ability to do telemedicine.
Yes.
Is that one of the concerns?
That's correct, yes. We do operate in a manner that tries to use the modern technology as much as possible. And this will disrupt those services as well. Using telemedicine, using teleradiology, having a physician in Anchorage supervise the actual process in a small rural health clinic, that's going to affect those processes.
So in the, Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. the zeal to overprotect, you could cause a denial of services.
That's correct.
There's probably good motives, but it might have a...
Yeah, I think the motivation is good. I mean, we're all concerned about safety. And, you know, there have been mistakes. I think you'll hear about some of them today. But the fact is, you'll never have a perfect system. There'll be mistakes, assuming this bill became law. You'll still have mistakes. That's not going to change. But now you'll have an additional layer, additional licensing, additional expenses. And again, in an urban setting, that may not be a big thing, where you have a staff of 50. But in the rural setting, which is where some of our most critical services are provided, in the most hard-to-serve areas, then this is a significant factor. And that's why we cannot support it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, the committee substitute that we adopted today incorporated two particularly, I think, significant sections designed and focused on ameliorating some of the sort of over-regulatory aspects of the previous bill version. Have you considered those in making your remarks?
Yes, I have. I think, as I mentioned earlier, as user-friendly as you can make it, they've probably achieved that. But the bottom line is still there, which is people are going to have to do additional training, additional testing, additional expense in order to do the services they're presently providing. The two-year delay in effective date means that those people who are out there who would come under the provision of these requirements would have time to comply. But once the cycle kicks in, you're back to doing things that we believe are simply unnecessary.
Go ahead.
Would you have a different opinion on the bill if it did not include the qualifications for radiologic imager, rather it was just limited to dealing with the radiologic technologists?
You're talking about the limited radiology provision?
Yes.
Yeah. I think if you... I'd have to think about that. That might change my opinion, but I'd like to think about that.
Your argument goes and is really limited and focused on the ability to, and again, excuse my layman's terms, but to perform essentially x-ray services,
correct.
Radiologic x-rays,
right.
As opposed to folks that are actually out there administering nuclear medicine,
right.
And some pretty serious
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, I through the chair, I think that would relieve some of the concern, yes, because the people who are performing the nuclear medicine, the other more comprehensive types of services, I think those people are already licensed and trained, and I'm not certain that this would affect them at all. I mean, it would require them to do some additional, go through some additional hoops, but those people are doing the kind of complex practice that really is not the focus of my concern.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I take that comment under advisement as we move forward here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Any other questions for Mr. Ford? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Ford. Okay, we're going to go ahead and go on the teleconference. Looks like the first one we have is Clyde Pierce.
This is Clyde Pierce.
Clyde, yes. Go ahead, sir.
I'm a radiation inspector for the state of Alaska, and as a result, I travel throughout the state and inspecting facilities of all types, not just medical, but medical is a major part of that. And with all due respect to Mr. Ford, I would have to disagree with some of his assertions, and I apologize that I have not provided something that I can see at this point would have been very useful, the number of complaints lodged. I do get complaints, and I am required to investigate, and one of my reasons for concern about radiation exposure in Alaska is because of the kind of things that I find when I investigate. One of the most egregious was right there in Anchorage, where I found in a small clinic patients were getting, I don't know what the total dose is, I only know that the minimum that they were receiving was 64 times the amount necessary for an optimum procedure. 64 times, that's 6,400% of the dose they should have received. And it was because the operator didn't know what she was doing, and she was trying to do her best. I inspected another clinic in a rural part of Alaska, where the two people who were operating the equipment were not trained. They had, quote, some training, but they did not appreciate the fact you'd never practice on each other, and they x-rayed each other. And another clinic, actually there are two places down in southeast where they were using a kind of x-ray screen, which intensifies the effect of radiation, but it gives off a particular color of light that affects the film, and you have to make sure the film that you use is matched to the kind of light the screen uses. So the old technology used blue-sensitive film and blue-emitting screens. The new uses green-emitting screens and green-sensitive film. They had mixed the old and new technology, and I was able to demonstrate to them that their exposures were 8 to 10 times higher than they should have been if they simply had stuck with the old technology. These are just some examples, but I see this all over the state. And up in Fairbanks, I was in an office where they had a gassy x-ray tube. A lot of people don't know that x-ray tubes will become gassy over time. This means that they develop a leak, and that interferes with the operation and makes the operation unpredictable. And so I do a test called a reproducibility test to see if they can get three exposures that are exactly the same amount of radiation for the same technique. On this particular machine, I made 12 exposures, and there were no two that were within the plus or minus 10% requirement. And I can go on with many examples. And I agree that licensing may not be the only answer or even the best answer, but the other solutions that I have proposed have been outright rejected as, a truth in packaging, for example, that says we have not been adequately trained here, but we'll x-ray you if you allow us. Most people would not like that. I did I've done a national survey out of my office, which is in process still, but I asked four questions. And this is throughout all of the 41 states that now license technologists. Did the implementation of licensure in your state create a technologist shortage? None of them have said that it did. Did it create an increase in salaries as a result of some kind of restriction? No. Were there any clinics closed? None has had any clinic closed. Was access restricted? Not one case of that has occurred. In regards to the question of dose related to dental, there are some significant differences. One is the part of the body that's being exposed. Another is the maximum milliamp, which is the amount of current available from an x-ray machine in a dental office, is normally 15 mA, whereas in an ordinary medical machine, it's 300 or the very lowest energies, and they can go to over 1,000 mA. So there's a tremendous difference in magnitude there. Also, the dental offices use a very, very small beam, small diameter, whereas a medical machine, you can open this machine up to basically spray the whole body if you chose to do that. In terms of trained and supervised, there's another problem because the physician assistants, Ed Hall and Don Smith, have given public testimony that they don't know how to operate the machine, and they believe that most of their members don't either. And I don't have a problem with that. They're PAs, they have a job to do, and it's not necessarily operating an x-ray machine. But also Dr. Worley said the same about medical physicians. And again, physicians have a very high level of responsibility in diagnosis and treatment of patients. But the problem is, if you don't have somebody there who knows what they're doing with the x-ray machine, you do have a problem. And the National Institute of Health has confirmed that x-rays are a carcinogen even at low energies. In other states, they have lowered the occupational exposure limits because of some new findings. Those changes have not occurred in Alaska. So I do have a number of concerns, and if anyone can come up with a better idea than licensure, and I understand licensure is not a cure-all for everything. We license doctors and PAs and nurses and architects and a whole lot of people, and sometimes you get bad actors, and at least the license does give you some mechanism for addressing the problems. But for those reasons, I think that Tom Anderson's office has received a letter from my my supervisor's boss, Dr. Richard Monsager, Division of Public Health, stating that we do support the intent of this bill, and this latest version looks like a pretty good compromise. I'm open for any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pierce. Any questions for Mr. Pierce? We do have one, Representative Petula.
Thanks. Your information that you supplied to the committee was actually pretty frightening in terms of the areas around the state that don't have proper training. But how many people are doing the kind of work that you do, Mr. Pierce? I mean, is it you alone, or do you have an office? How many people go around the state looking at the radiological machinery and the people who run it?
Well, I have an office in the state laboratory in Anchorage, and for the state of Alaska, I'm the only individual who does this. There are two individuals who work for the federal government out off the campus of the Alaska Native Health Facility, and they inspect a small number of facilities that are under the federal government.
Can I ask that
sure, go
question?
Ahead.
Do you think that maybe if there were more of you, plus there was an education program, and then I'm also wondering about languages, you know, also we're much better at asking patients themselves about how many x-rays they had or some sort of system where we actually kept track of that might be even more effective than actually requiring some form of licensure?
Well, there's a problem. There are several different problems. One of them is the enforcement. We actually have legislation right now under the radiation control regulations that says that you must be trained, but we don't. What does that mean? And we've heard testimony that these people operating x-ray machines are trained. And Ron Dice out at the Native Hospital conducts an excellent course, but it's a very, very short course. And this is not something you can learn to do by just learning about radiation safety. An inspection I did recently in Fairbanks, I look through the throwaway bin because that can be very instructive. And what I discovered was 40% of the repeat exposures were because of mispositioning of the patient. Now, you would think positioning, well, is that radiation safety or not? Well, it certainly is if you have to re-expose the patient because of it. And so this person had learned to push some buttons, but they didn't know anatomy, and they did not know accurate radiological positioning. And so they were guessing at positions, and well, this wasn't good, so then they did it again, and well, that's not quite right, so they did it again. And the problem is that with radiation that's unique, it's two things at least. One is the latent effect, so that cancers caused by radiation don't appear immediately. Like if you're driving too fast, you know right away when you hit a car, you did the wrong thing. Some of these cancers don't occur until a decade or more later. The other is that very, very few practitioners even have had the training or knowledge to recognize actually a radiation injury. And so it could be right there in front of them and they wouldn't see it. If you go to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration website, they have numerous examples of radiation burns during cardiac catheterizations. Now, that's not a procedure done in the bush, for example. It is done in the larger hospitals. But most of those occurred when the physician operating the machine was not even aware after the procedure that the person had been injured. And that didn't become apparent until later, and yet you can see cavitating lesions as a result of excess radiation.
Right. Any other questions for Mr. Pierce? Seeing none, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's go on to the Matt
Chairman.
Yes.
To reiterate, Mr. Pierce was in what capacity?
He is the Department of Health and Human Services. Are you the director, sir?
Chief of Radiological Health from the state of Alaska.
Okay.
So we're
go ahead, Chris.
Your exact capacity here in the testimony you presented was on behalf of who, sir?
The Department of Health for the state of Alaska.
Okay. So it is an overall position of the Department of Health and Social Services.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. I don't think he's up there.
Sounds like it.
Okay, very good. Let's go on to Metsu Valley. We have
William Ressinger, is that correct?
It's William Ressinger.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. I'm a physician. I live in Palmer, and I'm a radiologist who has practiced in Alaska since 1984. And I wish to speak in support of the bill. My years of experience in radiology have given me insight into the usefulness and the risks of medical imaging. There is always a balance between the benefits and the risks of employing ionizing radiation for medical diagnosis. Education and experience are needed to maintain that balance. Safely producing diagnostically useful images requires knowledge of such subjects as radiation protection, anatomy, positioning, exposure factors, indications for the examination, and the function of the equipment. A limited radiographic imager described in the bill should have the basic training and experience with which the bill proposes. HB 150 is not designed to burden medical providers unnecessarily, but would rather assure that minimum standards of safety and quality are met. Now, as a radiologist, I would not consider myself the most appropriate person to train or supervise medical personnel in modern medical therapy or surgery. Likewise, I realize that many specialists are very competent radiographically in their discipline, but I would not expect that physicians in general would be the most expert in training or supervising medical imagers. I am aware that humility is not a defining characteristic of my profession, but I would suggest that the colleagues I have most admired are those who understood their limits, staying within their sphere of expertise and refraining from other areas. My pastor often reminds me that a blind spot is just what it says, a problem which one cannot see. This analogy is appropriate to radiology, which is a very visual specialty. If I miss an abnormality on a radiograph, that finding becomes a blind spot for me. Radiographic diagnosis requires visual perception, even when viewing the best quality image or the most uncomplicated image. Radiologists are constantly fine-tuning their perceptive skills in order to reduce misdiagnoses or misinterpretations. In our practice, my radiologist partners have detected my blind spots, and I have done the same for them. I am not demeaning other physicians, but as part of my day-to-day work, I have found abnormalities missed on radiographs performed in remote areas or offices. Sometimes the problem lies in the quality of the images. Even the simplest image of a finger can demonstrate a subtle abnormality that suggests a serious systemic disease if the quality of the image is sufficient. In many aspects of medicine, we are now required to comply with national standards, such as the production and interpretation of mammograms. I know personally that compliance can be burdensome, but when the criteria are reasonable, I accept the extra effort necessary to improve the standard of care. I understand that 41 other states have already made provisions similar to HB 150 and have enacted them into law. And as far as I can see, the proposed requirements are reasonable, and they should result in a beneficial effect. I believe this bill would help reduce blind spots in Alaska's medical imaging community. Thank you. And I'll answer any questions if you like.
Okay. We do have a question, Richard Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, thank you, Doctor, for a very clear presentation here. I also submit to you that legislators aren't always the most humble crowd either.
Okay.
But you talked, and to me, and again, with apologies, I'm not in the medical profession, and I don't really understand the sort of some of the depths of your licensure issues, but I was hearing you walking a line between preparing a radiologic image, taking the picture, so if allow me a layman's term, but making the image versus interpreting or reading the image.
That's correct.
With this bill, I guess I don't... Currently, these sort of limited radiologic technicians that they're looking at here, would that be licensing them to read images? Or
no.
Is that the providence of your profession?
That's the providence of the radiologist. They would be just licensed to take the image and would be given a basic training so they could do a good job.
Okay, so they're strictly taking the picture. It's still, you know, obviously someone with other qualifications to legally read and interpret it.
That's correct.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, have a follow-on, and Doctor, someone that's obviously testifying as passionately as you have here, you've certainly heard the arguments on both sides of the issue. I guess, how would you respond to, say, the earlier testimony we had here about this bill placing an, you know, an inappropriate and unnecessary burden, particularly on rural Alaska providers?
Well, I am very sensitive to that, and as I indicated there, I wouldn't want unnecessary burdens placed. But I do believe, and I think others have already said, that efforts are being made to keep this to a minimum. Sometimes it's a trade-off. We have to have a minimum standard to be assured that we have good quality images, but we can't go overboard and regulate to the point of economic problems and major dislocations for people. So it's a balance, but I, as I say, in certain instances, I think it's worth the trade-off.
Good. Thank you. I guess you just reiterating yourself, but you do perceive in your professional capacity that there is a legitimate, there is a risk in public that we legitimately have a need to establish additional regulation.
Yes, and I didn't elaborate on it, and I really can't because of privacy issues, but I can say that in the years that I've been practicing since 1969, I have seen images come through that, if they'd been performed better, might have made the diagnosis earlier. I know that for a fact. And so it is a matter of personal concern, yes.
Thank you, Doctor. I sincerely appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate your testimony this afternoon. And appreciate you taking time out. We do have a request. If you could send your fax your testimony to us. Can I give you our fax number so that you could, I don't know, do you have something written down?
Yes, I do. I have it written down, and I'll give it to the lady here at the legislative office, and we'll send it down.
Okay. Our fax number, I'll just give it to you quick, is 465-6813.
6813. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go on now to Donna Elliott.
Hi, thank you for hearing my testimony. My name is Donna Elliott. I am speaking on behalf of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the Alaska Tribal Health System. And I would just like to reiterate and support any of the comments and testimony that were previously heard by Mike Ford of the Alaska Native Health Board. And so as to save time, I don't want to, you know, be redundant and repeat what he had said, but if for those who aren't aware, ANTHC is part of the Alaska Tribal Health System. It's a network of tribes linked by common goals and objectives. Our goal is to ensure that all Alaska Natives have access to a comprehensive and integrated tribally managed health care delivery system for the continued improvement of health and well-being of Alaska Native people. Currently, it's already quite difficult to retain qualified and licensed x-ray technician staff in rural areas. It has historically been a challenge not only for ANTHC, but also for other Alaska Native hospitals and regions within the tribal health system. There are many x-ray technicians employed at ANMC in Anchorage who already and currently provide quality, complete, and full point radiological care for our service population. HB 150 would place an unnecessary burden on many of the x-ray technicians currently employed at these regional rural hub facilities, as well as rural clinics throughout the state, are impacting an already complex and costly system of rural health care delivery. Additional licensure criteria for x-ray technicians within the tribal health system would require a lot of time and money to train and staff x-ray technicians, contributing to higher costs of providing care that's already expensive. Current unlicensed staff within the rural system who take x-rays, who may often take better ones than even licensed people that are exemptions, will be negatively impacted as a result. And access to good jobs for village residents and infrastructure will be decreased and told that they aren't qualified. We appreciate the user friendliness and the steps that Mr. Anderson has placed forward in HB 150. I want to thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, we just don't feel that it would fit well into the rural health care delivery model. Thank you.
Okay. We do have some questions for you. Let's see. Let's start with Representative Jewell.
Hi, Donna.
Hi, Uncle Reggie.
The plot thickens.
Donna, what would be the impact of the delivery system in rural Alaska if this legislation is adopted?
I believe that, well, the consortium believes that there would be a negative impact in terms of delivery of care or relay of care, in the sense that creating, you know, more licensure, more provisions for people that were already comprehensively training, including health aid practitioners, et cetera, it would just be another hoop to jump through.
Would it impact the workforce in any way?
We believe so. It would. We believe that it would create more of a burden or possibly an attraction for jobs that may not be available on a rural basis, and potential outposting of positions for people that maybe live more heavily in larger populated communities.
I do, but it might.
Richard Hopper.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, and I sincerely appreciate you indulging me in repeated questions. Donna, you know, I'm hearing in your testimony, and I think I believe I heard in the earlier testimony that you're perceiving a very important distinction between, and for lack of better words here, but let's just call it the urban environment and a rural environment, a rural service deliveries and urban service deliveries. And I'm hearing the, you know, you're discussing, you know, jobs, availability of health care in a rural setting. Would your concerns with this bill be alleviated if somewhere in the exemption sections we allowed the radiologic imaging to go under current statute on an unregulated basis in whatever our definition would be of rural Alaska, but if we impose those restrictions on urban Alaska, would you be comfortable with something like that?
I'm not ready to provide additional comment in regards to that, but that would be a step forward, I believe, in my opinion.
Thank you very, very kindly. And your uncle's a great guy.
Uncle Joel, did you have a...
Yeah, I'm going to ask it.
Okay.
Donna?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason why we wouldn't want our current workforce to be certified, qualified to provide this service?
Is there any reason why we wouldn't want our current workforce to be licensed to provide this?
We have, because what, if I understand this right, we're talking about health aids, right? I mean, delivery in rural Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't we want them to be more qualified? Wouldn't we want them to get as much education, training, to achieve the highest level of quality, so that that quality could be passed on to the consumer? Me as a patient, if I walk in?
Yes, I believe we want it. I mean, that's part of our mission statement, is to, you know, we're striving for that in its existence, and we trust and fully support all of our physicians who are currently, you know, overseeing and training licensure of radiological techs who are currently providing those services. We believe that.
Paul?
Nope.
Okay. Very good.
Donna.
Any other questions for Ms. Elliott? Seeing none, thank you very much for joining us today. Okay, let's move on to Donna Wolfstrom. Am I saying that correctly?
You did fairly well. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Donna Rufsholm. I am the chair of the Alaska Society of Radiologic Technologists Legislative Affairs Committee. We're the writers of House Bill 150. We're often asked, why do we need this regulation in the state of Alaska? Why establish minimum standards for personnel who perform medical imaging procedures? Some of that has been answered today, but I'll kind of elaborate on it. The answer is safety to the patient, safety to the operator, and the necessity to establish standards that will assure that all Alaskans, no matter where they live, receive quality care when they have x-ray examinations. As a radiologic technologist who's had formal training, I know that radiation is a carcinogen and that the operators of medical imaging equipment deliver the largest portion of man-made radiation to the general public. I also know that there's no safe dose of radiation, that low-level radiation can be just as harmful as high levels of radiation. The average patient is not aware of these facts. They do not know how to evaluate the safety of the procedures that they have. They place all of their confidence in the healthcare worker who's performing the procedure. The average patient assumes that anyone who's providing care in a healthcare setting knows what they are doing and that they have received the proper education to perform their job. Passage of House Bill 150 will establish standards for individuals performing x-ray exams. Standards that presently do not exist in some clinical sites as shown by the examples of misuse of radiation documented by the State of Alaska Department of Radiological Health. A copy of that list is included in the information packet for House Bill 150 that was given to the Finance Committee members. We cannot blame the uneducated operators for the errors that they have made. They have not been required to get education that they need to do their job correctly, nor have they been given the opportunity. Opponents of House Bill 150 state that this is a financial burden. $229, the cost for one individual to take an extensive online limited scope program is equal to the reimbursement for one x-ray procedure. It's a very small amount to pay to assure patient safety. House Bill 150 will not change the way that small businesses and rural clinics operated. The committee recognizes the fact that the rural areas of the state have different needs than the urban areas and have worked hard with groups around the state to address those needs. We understand the importance of being able to provide radiology services for patient care, especially in the rural areas. We have made provisions in the bill to ensure that individuals who currently perform x-ray procedures at these sites will be able to continue to do so. The clinics will have no interruption in services while their staff receives training. There will be no loss of services in the rural areas or a reduction in patient access to quality and complete point of care. Given that requiring operators to be trained and tested does not increase costs, does not restrict access to patients, will not increase the salaries, will not force clinics to close, will not cause staffing shortages, will not create burdensome financial obligations to facilities, and the training can be completed at a place and time convenient to the operator, there should be no reason for any of us not to be the patient advocate and establish standards for persons performing radiology procedures. We've listened to testimony today, and you know we've listened to the concerns that the rural areas have. I think that we have made so many provisions in this bill to address those needs and concerns. We want to make sure that the people who are performing procedures in the rural areas can continue to do so. Those people who are performing x-rays today can continue to perform x-rays tomorrow if this bill will pass. Those people will not lose jobs. We're actually creating a new career path for these individuals in the rural areas. We're creating a limited scope radiographer position that they can carry to any other state that they should choose if they left the state of Alaska. We're trying very, very hard to meet all the needs of the communities. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
We do have some questions. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Holm and then Representative Hart.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And Donna, thank you very much for your testimony today. If you've been listening to the testimony earlier, I asked the question as to why dental technicians and dentists did also not need to be licensed. And the comment, if I heard it correctly, was that they were not performing a high enough dosage on their patients, or the portion of the body that they're giving the dosage to was not as significantly important, although maybe their brains aren't, I don't know. But my question is, twice I've heard the comment that the carcinogenic effects of low-dose radiation are equally as problematic as at high dose. And so my question to you is, why does your group think that dental technicians and dentists aren't equally at
or the public's equally at risk from them. And to go along with this, maybe you can comment on another one that I that follows some of the other comments I've heard today, and that is, since there have been no reported cases of damage, are we not just looking for a solution, or providing a solution looking for a problem?
In answer to your questions, first of all, when we started writing House Bill 150 or 186, as it was called, 2 years ago, we exempted the dentists and the dental hygienists because they are regulated under their own state statutes. They actually, Clyde Pierce can answer this as well. He, through the Department of Radiation Health, is actually not even inspecting their equipment. They are exempted under their own laws and regulations. As far as no reported cases, as a healthcare professional, I hope that I never have a case that I have to report to you because of the misuse of radiation. Unfortunately, what happens is that it's a latent effect. Somebody could get an x-ray today, have an overdose of radiation, and may not develop a cancer for 10 or 15 years. And how do you track that back? It's very difficult to do. We do have cases in the state of Alaska where there were x-rays that were taken that were not of diagnostic quality, and there have been misdiagnoses on those. Unfortunately, those cases, we can't report those cases because of litigation. They do exist. We know that they exist, but we can't bring those cases to you in the legislature. I hope that House Bill 150 will give people the education so that they will not only be able to protect the patient, but also protect the operators. That's what this is all about. It's not just the patient, it's the operators also. They can protect themselves so that they're not going to be developing cataracts, thyroid cancers, breast cancers, and other diseases or cancers that can develop amongst people who perform radiology procedures.
Okay. Anything else, Representative
Hall? No, thank you very much. I'm not sure I got an answer to my question, but that's okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, let's call it to Representative Hawker.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. And ma'am, I'm working myself here to try to divine exactly, very precisely, where the issue between the opposing factions on this particular bill lies. I think I'm not hearing any disagreement amongst the communities that want, you know, about, you know, licensure and regulation of the folks that are out there, basically the nuclear medicine pharmacists and those sort of folks. I'm not hearing any disagreement there. But it's clearly in somewhere here in this taking a picture crowd, the radiologic imaging of some kind. And I'm starting to find a line here where the folks opposed to this bill, you know, you refer to things such as basic x-rays or like they call it, basic x-rays, as something being in a different category of risk than an x-ray delivered for something much, you know, to some more substantial mammography, MRIs, CT. Is there a delineation in somewhere, is there a gray line in services here somewhere where there is a lower risk factor service as opposed to a line that, you know, clearly you step over as a more high risk factor? And again, definitely basic x-ray. Talk to me about basic x-rays.
Basic x-rays, we consider basic x-rays as your extremity imaging, chest x-rays, abdominal x-rays, skull x-rays. The more sophisticated procedures would be CT, CAT scans, CT exams, mammography exams, MRI exams, ultrasound procedures, although some of those procedures do not use x-ray. X-ray, no matter whether it's low dose or high dose, is a carcinogen. It does not matter. What we're generally the what we're seeing in the rural areas is they do not have sophisticated equipment such as CT mammography. And if they do have mammography, it's regulated by the FDA, heavily regulated by the FDA. So those people would have to be certified fully licensed technologists that's FDA mandated. As far as the general radiology procedures, that is is what we're seeing in the small clinics. So those are procedures that if somebody injures themselves, whether it be in a snowmobile accident or just in daily functions, they would be going into a clinic and having a procedure, what we call a general X-ray procedure, performed. And most likely not having anything more sophisticated than that. The rural clinics cannot afford the more sophisticated equipment of CT and MRI. And those individuals that do perform those procedures are registered technologists who have had additional training in those sophisticated modalities. I hope I answered your question. If not, please let me know and I'll elaborate a little bit more.
You know, ma'am, you're helping me understand this quite a bit more clearly here. Were there to be a line being drawn here, not with a zero sort of a, not drawing a zero tolerance line in this statute, but drawing a line that allowed basic, for lack of a better word, because I don't know any better word here, but to allow basic X-rays to be performed without this particular licensing requirement, would that be a bill? Would you be so opposed to that sort of a line that you'd start opposing your own bill, or would it be something you'd reluctantly accept?
From what I have seen in working in the state of Alaska for 22 years, I really feel that it doesn't matter who you are. If you're taking X-rays, you need education. We see the whole gamut. We see someone walking into flipping hamburgers at McDonald's one day and then going in to work in a clinic the next day and start taking X-rays. I know people who have done that without any training, no training at all. The person who worked before them might say, this is a button you turn on, this is a knob you push, and this is a book. Look, and this is what you want to take what you want your picture to look like. They received no training at all. Someone who has attended the course that Clyde Pierce referenced earlier, Ron Dice's course, which is a week-long course in Anchorage, they get a minimum of training through that course. It's a bit better than going in without any training at all, but still there's a minimum of training. So I really, truly feel that no matter where we are, where we go to have our X-ray taken, that individual that's taking that X-ray should have some sort of standard of education. We need to establish that so that everybody has some knowledge of what they are doing. And if we don't establish that, we're just back to ground zero. We're not any better than where we are today. And Clyde certainly has a lot of good examples of what he's seeing when he's doing his inspections. That's not good. I wouldn't want to be that patient who received 64 times the amount of radiation that I needed to when I had my X-ray. And that was an incident that was reported. We know there's a lot more of those incidents going on that aren't reported. And we'd like to make sure that that doesn't happen.
At the risk of asking you to speculate, there's clearly some passionate testimony against this bill, and I'm seeing that the passion really goes to that so-called basic level. I'm not hearing any objection to these more higher intensity, more sophisticated techniques. Why do you have a perspective on why is there such strong opposition from that particular community? Does this bill threaten to eliminate a job class in the state, or is it an issue where are the licensed folks attempting to take over something that has been performed very well but without licensed folks? I mean, is there some where are the territories being drawn here?
The licensed technologists in the state of Alaska will not go to the rural areas to work. I can guarantee you that. There's not enough work out there for an individual to be hired, first of all. The pay won't be there, second of all. We're not creating more jobs for ourselves by passage of House Bill 150. There will be more jobs available and created for the folks in the rural areas, the limited scope folks. Those people who are there now will not lose their jobs. And I know that has been a lot of the concerns of the people from the rural areas, is that the people who are taking x-rays today won't be able to do their job tomorrow because of House Bill 150. We've made provisions so that will not happen. If they need education and training, then they can get it online in the clinic or in their home setting. They do not have to leave their community to get education in Anchorage. We've identified an online course that you can sign up for today if you choose to, or tomorrow if you choose to, for $229. So the financial portion is not prohibitive. We have made provisions for people who have been performing x-rays in those areas that they have an extended period of time to receive this education. So it doesn't have to happen within a 1 year or 6 month period. They have, actually by the time the bill passes, another 2 years, so it'll be a full four-year period before they'd actually have to show that they have the formal education if they need it. We've also made provisions for waiving the program. If people can show that they have had some sort of education in their setting where they are now, or education through another course, they can actually waive the program by passing an examination that we have identified online. Again, they don't have to travel to Anchorage for the exam. So I truly do not know why people are opposing this bill other than for financial reasons, and we've certainly tried to identify educational resources that will keep that the financial component of the things down. It shouldn't create a hardship. $229 for an online course is very, very inexpensive. It's giving someone the education that they can carry with them for the rest of their working career if they so do choose. And it's hard for me to understand, as a healthcare professional who always seeks education, I always want to better myself and try to educate myself in the health profession. It's hard for me to understand why other individuals who are in the healthcare profession also don't support that.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Donna, for joining us this afternoon. We do have one more person, I believe, to testify, and so why don't we go ahead and take the last testimony, and we're going to hold this bill over, probably take it up Thursday, and that way if people do have amendments they want to make or want to have some more discussion on this topic, they'll have some time. By the way, for the committee's record too, we work faxed a testimony just recently from Ed Hall, so you should all have that in front of you as well. Okay, let us go on then to Shelley Hughes.
Good afternoon, and thank you. For the record, this is Shelley Hughes with Alaska Primary Care Association. Thank you, Chair and members, for this opportunity to testify today. Alaska Primary Care Association represents 115 community health centers and 24 health organizations, as well as other safety net providers throughout Alaska. And community health centers are not-for-profit safety net providers and operate on very slim margins. And the great majority of our sites are actually located in rural and remote areas of the state. And we've been monitoring this bill so that our rural sites would not face hardships in securing, affording, and retaining licensed technicians, and so that they would not be forced to transport patients to cities at a high price and causing delayed treatment and additional pain and suffering for the patients. And although we believe that licensure in itself does not guarantee safety improvements, and that actually quality assurance checks truly would better ensure these desired improvements, such as Clyde, who inspects equipment, if there could be inspections on the operators of the equipment, this would ensure safety to a higher degree than licensure. But having said that, Alaska Primary Care Association would like to thank the bill's sponsor, Representative Anderson, for reworking the language as much as he has to better accommodate our rural community health centers. But on behalf of our members today, I am testifying today that if this bill does indeed go forward, that you address a remaining concern and request. And I'd like to turn your attention to page 6 of the latest work draft. And please note the disparity between the two-year validity of the temporary permit, and I'm looking on at lower cap section C on line 13. The two-year validity of the temporary permit allowed for a person with 2 years prior experience. And then if you look down on up on line 9, and this is addressing the one-year validity of the temporary permit allowed for a person without prior experience in section small letter B. So it's line 9 and line 13. And Alaska Primary Care Association requests that the word one in section B on line 9 be changed to the word two to allow less experienced and new hires equitable time for examination preparation and licensure attainment. So in conclusion, we'd ask that the House Finance Committee address this disparity and adjust the language of the bill if it does indeed go forward. And thank you again for allowing me this platform to present our concern.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony this afternoon, Ms. Hughes. Okay, I think we, that's everyone online, is that correct? Okay, and I am mistaken, we do have one person who's signed up here in Juneau, Barbara Huff. Good afternoon, Barbara.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Finance Committee. My name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I'm Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and we would like to go on record supporting CS House Bill 150. I unfortunately wasn't able to listen to all of the testimony here. I have sat in on quite a few of the other committee hearings as the bill has moved not only this particular session but the last couple of years. And I think trying to reiterate some of our perspective. First of all, I should go on record stating that we do represent radiologic technologists at South Peninsula Hospital in Homer, and they are already currently required by the hospital to be certified. So it's become a somewhat of a non-issue. But we also represent CNAs, certified nurse assistants, and I believe that certified nurse assistants also work in the rural as well as the urban area. We also represent truck drivers. We have truck drivers that are required to have or possess a certified driver's license to drive a truck. I guess on behalf of the members that we represent in the healthcare industry, and I think a comment that was made by one of the individuals that spoke earlier, this really is about a certification that assures that the training that everybody is receiving and the work that's being done, whether you're in the urban area or in the rural area, is done at the same level and at the same expertise. You don't have somebody who is training, say, in a rural hospital that may use a different technique than somebody in an urban area. And if I travel around the state and I just happen to have to attend a particular facility in a rural area, my expectation as a citizen in the state of Alaska, taking my Teamster hat off, would be that the level of service that would be provided, whether I'm in an urban area or a rural area, would be at that same level. We do not believe that this is a bill that would put individuals out of jobs. This bill has gone through many, many renditions. It started out including, there was a question earlier regarding the dental hygienist, and of course that issue was discussed. I think it's been discussed probably rather eloquently here in earlier testimony. I think it is a very important bill. It is something that hopefully with due diligence and consideration, while some folks may disagree that it, the type of work that's being done. And well, actually, I'll go on record and add an additional step, because there was a question asked, well, we have x-rays and then we have those individuals that are looking at taking tests for MRIs or CTs. Through South Peninsula Hospital, we've actually developed a career ladder training that does a couple of things. While they are required to be certified for the basic job, we've also instituted some additional certifications, encouraging folks to go back to get the additional training so that they're able to cross-train into a multiple of different areas within the radiologic technologist field. So we see it as a career ladder, a career building, and I think first and foremost that the individuals that are working in our healthcare system are adequately trained and able to perform a service, whether it's in an urban or in a rural area. And I ask for your support and answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you, Carver. Any questions? Seeing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Okay. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on this particular bill? No. We'll go ahead and close public hearing. I do see Mr. Uron, your name is on here for the fiscal note, if there's any questions, correct? So if we are bringing this bill back up on Thursday, would you be able to join us Thursday? Yes, Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For a question relating to the public testimony that was just closed.
Sure.
The strongest opposition that, you know, than it has been in, obviously based on the testimony that's available in our packets here, at least the commentary, the greatest opposition to this bill has been from the Academy of Physician Assistants, the Alaska Academy of Physician Assistants. I'm just curious, we had no testimony from them, and they seem to be voicing the loudest opposition. I'm wondering, did we miss someone today in testimony?
I think we caught everybody that was online and everyone that's here.
I can answer that.
Sure,
Mr. Hall wanted to testify, but he had patients coming at the time of the meeting, so he was unable. And my name is Luann Christian, House Finance Committee staff. I should know better.
Yes, you should. Is it your wish to perhaps invite him Thursday to testify,
Mr. Chairman, and again, I was unaware of the circumstances that were just described here, but in the and actually, I have full disclosure, I believe Mr. Hall may well be a constituent of my own, has been in regular communication with myself, I believe Representative Foster and some others, and really does represent the passionate opposition. I sincerely appreciate the opportunity for invited testimony from Mr. Hall.
Sure. We can do that. Like I said, I think we'll take up the supplemental on Thursday. But I don't think it'll take the full time, so perhaps you can bring us back up about 2:30 or whenever we get the supplement. Yes, Representative Kelly?
Just on that point that Representative Hawker made, we had also PAC Don Smith, who also all of us received. Just so if we're going to be cracking it open again, maybe the message can get to him, since that is, those two folks have been strongly opposed.
I hate to do that, Representative Kelly, because then, in all fairness, I need to let the other side rebuttal. I mean,
then you really shouldn't, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, we've had plenty of opportunity for public testimony today. I wouldn't be opposed to one person, but I hate to crack it open to. Go ahead.
Just needed to try.
One other
comment, because it may not come back, is this is one that twists you and turns you back and forth. I'm concerned from a cost standpoint. I'm concerned that if you don't take that picture of the kid that fell off the snow machine in Nikolai or Arctic, he's going to get on an airplane, because the liability and the concerns are going to fly into the chief in Fairbanks or down to the medical center, and exposes us to tremendous cost. So I don't want to see us kill the opportunity in the areas where you don't have lots of services like that, and raise the cost dramatically in an area that isn't pointed out here, and that's putting somebody in the Navajo, Gitman, Fairbanks, Gitman. So, and I've seen that, how that works. So I'm concerned about that. I'm also concerned that there isn't the depth in the rural communities. If the person from the health clinic that shoots, that might have the rating is downriver somewhere else that day, there isn't that depth. And if we've got somebody else here that says, well, I know how to do that, I watch Mary do it every week, we're gonna whack them, what, $5,000? I just want to get a little bit of, get that out there. So I'm concerned about the cost, and yet I've heard these folks, I think a lot of us are getting torn back and forth. Representative Jewell's comment about the general desire to provide on-ramps for folks and becoming more professional, getting certified. This is an interesting bill for one that that is on its surface fairly simple. So, okay. I just a couple of points there to throw out that maybe Mr. Hilliard could bring back to us some slant on the amount of penalty, the depth in the bush that is there, and might help us out a little bit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kelly. And I think what we'll do is, like I said, we'll go ahead and take amendments for the bill next on Thursday. We'll go ahead and let Mr. Hall testify since he had patients and was unable to testify. Certainly the person you mentioned, Mr. Smith, I think we have had quite a bit of correspondence by email and faxes from Mr. Smith. And then if the committee is still not comfortable with the bill, in the committee, we can keep it longer. But I'm hoping the 2 days here we have here will give people an opportunity to come up with any amendments and maybe discuss with the sponsor. And yes.
Just one other thing. Sure. If we water down much more, we've got nothing. So. I recognize that too. If you go too far, you might as well pitch it out in the creek because it's not worth the
proper permit.
Okay. Well, very good. Let's tomorrow we're going to take up the House Bill 334 that we didn't get to today, the municipal property tax deferral exemption. Also, Representative Wyrick has indicated that he is ready on House Bill 315, which had to do with the permanent fund dividend. And 273. Okay, and then also we'll be taking up House Bill 379, Controlled Substances, House Bill 395, Fire Season Start Date, and that's it. Those four bills for tomorrow. Wednesday we'll take up the first supplemental and finish any bills that we have, and Thursday will be another supplemental. And this bill we just had. Anything else come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned.